This is Side 3 of International Portfolio. Are we a nation at risk, as a recent Department of Education report contends? To explore this question with a leading authority on education, here's Donald S. Zagoria.
With me today to discuss the educational crisis in the United States is Mr. Fred Hechinger, educational columnist for the New York Times. Mr. Hechinger, I have in front of me a report commissioned by the U.S. Secretary of Education, Mr. Bell, titled A Nation at Risk, The Imperative for Educational Reform. The report begins by saying, and I'm quoting here, "The educational foundations of our society are presently being eroded by a rising tide of mediocrity that threatens our very future as a nation and a people. If an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose on America the mediocre educational performance that exists today, we might well have viewed it as an act of war." What do you think about that conclusion? Is it overstated? Is it accurate?
I think it's overstated, but it's useful. It alerts the public to the fact that there's a need for change. It wouldn't have been overstated, I think, if it had been said about 5 years ago. It ignores that there have been real improvements in American education and that this is really the time to build on those improvements. What troubles me a little about it is that there's certainly a lot of mediocrity in the United States, but the schools are only in a sense a reflection of it. There's mediocrity on the assembly lines, there's mediocrity in the executive suites, and it isn't surprising that there's also mediocrity in the schools. And to that extent, I think it's a good thing to point to the need for improvement, but it really calls for an effort of the society as a whole.
Well, let me read to you also some of the international comparisons cited in this report. First of all, they say that comparisons of student achievement show that on 19 academic tests, American students were never first or second in comparison with other industrialized nations, and they were last 7 times. That the average achievement of high school students on most standardized tests is now lower than it was 26 years ago. That the College Board Scholastic Aptitude Tests demonstrate a virtually unbroken decline from 1963 to 1980. That they reveal consistent declines in recent years in such subjects as physics and English, that there was a steady decline in science achievement scores of 17-year-olds, and that the average tested achievement of students graduating from college is also lower. Now, what about those figures?
Well, let me use the one that's probably most widely known, the Scholastic Aptitude Test scores. It's true they have been declining for something like 12 years in a row, but the fact is that in the last 2 years, the decline has been reversed. It also, I think, ought to be remembered that in the period during which the decline took place, an enormous expansion of the number of students who attended school took place. And that leads me to the international comparison. It's absolutely true that if you take the entire school population in the United States, we do far worse than the other industrial countries. But it's not a fair comparison because we send virtually everybody through high school, and most of the other countries send a selected proportion through high school. On the other hand, if you take roughly the top 10% of each high school class and compare those with the top 10% of the other industrial nations, the United States really does quite well, and in many instances does better than the other countries.
Well, now, this report divides into 4 sections and 4 sets of recommendations. The first one deals with the content of education, the second with the expectations that our school systems have, the third has to do with the time devoted to the educational process, and the fourth has to do with teaching. Now, let me begin with content. Basically, what this report argues is that education in the high schools is something of a curricular smorgasbord, they call it. Too much student choice, no central core of studies.
I totally agree with that analysis. I think it's entirely true that in many schools, the system of excessive choice has really sort of pushed what we used to call the hard subjects, the academic subjects, aside. And I think that's unacceptable. It's particularly unacceptable if the, say, 25 or 30% of the most talented students don't take those subjects. And in that respect, this report, I think, very wisely goes back to what Dr. Conant proposed in an earlier high school reform movement in the late 50s, and it specifically states that students ought to take a certain number of years of the hard subjects such as English, history, or social studies, mathematics, science, and foreign languages, and I totally agree with that. Now, I don't think at the same time that this should exclude the student choice of some electives, because we also have to consider that it's terribly important to react to the different interests of different students.
Right. Now, on the expectations that we have as a society about our educational process, this report argues that there is too little homework, that there is much too little attention to science and mathematics, and at a time when we are moving into the computer age, we are becoming a nation of scientific and technological illiterates. Too little attention devoted to foreign language study, unchallenging textbooks. How do you react to that?
I agree with all of that. There should certainly be more effort. Whether this means specifically more homework in every school, I don't know. There should certainly be a requirement to complete a sequence, of course. As you mentioned, foreign languages. I think the lack of foreign language instruction in the United States is very close to a scandal. This is one area in which an international comparison is very useful. It's virtually impossible to graduate from a high school anywhere in the Western world without having working knowledge of at least one and frequently two foreign languages. And I think this is terribly important for the United States, particularly today when we are not alone in the world. And so, yes, I would go along with those recommendations.
Now, the third issue they address themselves to in this report is the amount of time that we devote as a nation to the educational process. They point out that in the United States, the average high school day is about 6 hours, and we spend about 180 days a year in school, whereas in England and in other industrialized countries, the average day is 8 hours, and they spend about 220 days. They also say that the use of the time that is devoted to education is not always wisely utilized. A lot of students are studying cooking instead of mathematics, and in many high schools around the country, cooking and driver's education counts as much for a high school degree as mathematics, sciences, foreign languages, and so on. So is there a case for a longer school day and for a longer school year and for a wiser utilization of existing time?
I think there's a stronger case for a wiser utilization of the time we already have. I have observed education in countries where they do have longer school days and more days in the year, and I'm not persuaded that the additional time really is producing all that much in terms of education. But I thoroughly agree that we should have a hard look at the time that's available to us now and make the best possible use of it.
Right. Now, the final category that this report looks at has to do with the quality of teachers in the high schools. Basically, they're saying that we need better teachers, particularly in science and mathematics, that we have too many teachers from the bottom fourth of the graduating college students. What sorts of recommendations would you make for improving the quality of teaching?
Well, first of all, I would have put that recommendation at the head of the report. I think that, as a matter of fact, one of the deficiencies in past reform movements has been the attempt to make an end run around the teachers, to provide all kinds of magic solutions and hope that the teacher would not be that important. I don't think that can be done. And that leads to another aspect that the report has ignored. Many of these recommendations do require additional funds for education. You cannot simply get better teachers in a market economy without paying comparable wages. So I think the first step has to be to provide competitive salaries for teachers and to change the career pattern. At least the best of the teachers can move up beyond the ceiling that's now set for them. The second step, it seems to me, would be to take a very hard look at teacher training and to make sure of two things. First of all, that teachers, particularly in the elementary schools, are trained in a situation of dealing with real children. Perhaps something like an internship or a residency before you give teachers a full license. The second requirement would be that teachers thoroughly trained in the subject areas in which they teach. And one of the absolutely essential aspects of the present reform cycle is for the major universities to get back seriously into teacher training.
I wonder if we could focus for a moment, Mr. Hechinger, on the teaching of science and mathematics. There obviously does seem to be a greater shortage of qualified teachers in those hardcore areas than in many other areas. Is it simply a matter of raising salaries, or what else needs to be done to make teaching of science and mathematics competitive with the very attractive opportunities available to science and math graduates in private industry?
Well, the crisis is certainly real. We've been losing the top science and math high school teachers at an enormous rate, something like 10% a year, to business and industry. And the reason is clear. The good science and math teacher can more than double his salary by moving out of the school. So part of the answer is clearly that we have to look at the marketplace and perhaps think about paying higher differential pay to science and math teachers than to other teachers. The other essential goes beyond money. It's to give the high school science and math teacher a standing in his or her field, the kind of standing that a college teacher has. And that means giving the science and math teacher a chance during the summer, perhaps, to work in industrial research, to do all the kinds of things that good college teachers can do, and not only to improve their income, but also to remain professionals in their field.
Well, is the bottom line here that the amount of money that is devoted to the schools in the various states is presently inadequate?
Yes, I think it's inadequate. Yes, money is important, but it also is a question of the way you deal with teachers. There are other careers where some people don't make a lot of money. But what makes them more desirable is that if you rise in the profession, you have a chance of bettering yourself economically. And since economic standing in our society also means social and professional standing, they go hand in hand. The Carnegie Foundation's report recommended over a period of years an increase of something like 25% in teacher salaries, plus a rearrangement of the career, so that at the top of the scale, you may have something like master teachers or people who are in charge of curriculum studies or who supervise teacher training on the job and who would go beyond the ordinary pay scale.
Is there anything else you'd like to say, Mr. Hechinger, about the educational situation in the United States?
Well, what I really want to say is that this report and others are enormously important because they're raising public consciousness about the importance of education. I think we are in a new era, so the publication of these reports are tremendously important to focus on the issues. What worries me about it is that as a country, we have a very short attention span. And the educator now really has a very clear mission to use this public interest and to move very rapidly into real reforms before the public loses interest.
And are you encouraged, just finally, by what's happened in the past 2 or 3 years?
I'm tremendously encouraged. I think there has been a public consciousness that education is important, partly because of the economic situation, the greater difficulty for young people to get jobs. Young people are more interested about their education. They are ready to respond to greater demands made of them and higher expectations for what they can do.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Mr. Fred Hechinger from the New York Times. This is Donald Zagoria for International Portfolio.
Next, National Review editor William F. Buckley, Jr. takes a new look at America's youth. The generation of the 60s brought up in affluence has had unparalleled privileges. Bill Buckley wants to know if these young people are spoiled forever or if there's hope for a change in their outlook.
Our guest today is Mr. Tom Wolfe. He has a new book out, The Purple Decades, an anthology of material he has written over the past 20 years. Mr. Wolfe has become, of course, among the 2 or 3 best-known American authors. His book, The Right Stuff, 2 or 3 years ago, won the National Book Award and is widely turn to, as are all of his essays, because they reveal a penetrating insight into much that is characteristic of America. We thought today to discuss, in general, some of the things that distinguished the last two decades and some of the things that are likely to distinguish the next decade. Mr. Wolf, what would you, looking back on it, say distinguished the 60s beyond the obvious turmoil over the Vietnam War?
I'd say the paramount thing was the fact that during the 60s, Americans got used to being rich. It took from about 1942, when the boom that we're still in began during the Second World War. It took us out of the Depression. I think there was a feeling that the Depression could happen all over again until about 1960. By this time, everyone, from not just young people, but also older people, began to feel that the boom was permanent. And that, I think, on any political issue, changed things everywhere in this country.
Now, is that a comprehensive use of the word boom, meaning medical care, for instance, is there available for anyone? Education, is there available for anyone? Access to culture? Or do you simply mean increase in cash flow?
All of those things. The boom that I'm talking about is something that is so big and so obvious that it isn't seen any longer. It's like the Big Dipper. The boom has been enormous. Nothing like it has ever happened in history. Wealth, starting in the early 1940s, began to pour into every sector, into every stratum of American life, down to the very bottom rungs of society, so that you have people who have the means to express themselves and to demand things. And this is the point that, to me, is crucial. Starting in the 60s, all sorts of people began to think like aristocrats. Aristocrats are, if we look back, people who feel that the rules don't really apply to them. And the outstanding example now is the idea that you should be able to get rid of your wife or husband immediately, anytime you want. They are disposable. This is an aristocratic notion. And when people get enough money and enough freedom, they begin to decide that they can live like aristocrats. And one of the things that was so spectacular in the 60s was the sight of young people with enough money to form their own societies and jettison the ordinary rules of behavior in some cases. And it was looked upon as a generation gap, a rebellion against oppression and so on. I think, oh, that's nonsense. It was simply they were able to live like aristocrats, so they did.
Well, maybe we should define aristocracy a little bit more closely. The aristocrat of the Middle Ages, for instance, was expected to build and live in castles, but he was also expected to go out and fight, if necessary. But we have really a hedonistic class, which may fancy itself as aristocratic, but denies the obligations of aristocracy. Wouldn't you say that there is that distinction?
Oh, sure. In fact, the people I'm talking about who try to live like aristocrats now don't even think of themselves as aristocrats. They simply have the money and the freedom. And the freedom is very important. I mean, the freedom in this country is just extraordinary. There's never been anything like it anywhere for it. Just all sorts of people. They have the freedom, so they simply exercise it.
Well, this was a phenomenon, in fact, that I think that was brilliantly identified by Ortega y Gasset in his famous book, in what was it, 35, in which he said that this was the first generation that accepted the fact of a patrimony. It was Europeans he was primarily discussing, but there was no reciprocal obligation to feed something on into the patrimony. Now, for instance, you have in America people who do enjoy their freedom, as you pointed out, who are not willing to entertain an empirical argument over whether we should have a draft, but go much beyond that and say that there is no obligation to serve, even under contingent circumstances of a perceptible national threat.
Yes, but I think it is possible to take the going momentum of the hedonistic life and turn it in another direction to achieve the same results. I'm thinking particularly of what happened in Vietnam. There's a wide belief that there was low morale among American fighting men in Vietnam. This is largely untrue. The morale was much higher than it was in Korea, perhaps not as high as in the Second World War, but in fact it was really quite good. And if you read accounts of men who fought in Vietnam, you'll see a kind of status or code managed to prevail. I'm thinking particularly of two books. One is called Fields of Fire by James Webb. Another is a new book called The 13th Valley by John DelVecchio. Both were men who fought in combat in Vietnam. And the thing that to this day these men are so frustrated by is that the world outside, that is the rest of America, doesn't realize it was possible to create esprit in Vietnam, of all places, half a world away from your home.
So what you're saying is that there is latent in America plenty of that spirit which generates from a recognition of a sort of chivalric obligation, and therefore there are certain latent trends of nobility, chivalry, and even Calvinism. You don't expect everything for nothing.
I think it could even be manipulated in pilot training. The system has evolved so that the young pilots end up in a world that has no windows. They live entirely in terms of the world of flying, and American pilots remain to this day, no matter what the war, perhaps the bravest fighting men. I mean, it's extraordinary the things that they will do.
Could anybody make any political headway in America today if he was required to announce his campaign by saying, I bring you nothing but blood, sweat, and tears?
I think it actually might appeal. It wouldn't have worked 5 years ago. It might work 2 years from now. That's a nice ring.
But must there be a palpable threat, or might it come as a result of a general feeling of overindulgence? In other words, might there be in the decade ahead a general hangover resulting from the feeling that everything has been demanded of other people, of the state, of education, of doctors, of teachers, and that nothing, no reciprocal gestures have in turn been proffered?
Yes, it's already happened. And what I think of as the third great awakening, which we're in the middle of right now, there's a tremendous religious movement in this country, is evidence of that. This is the third one of these religious surges. The Moonies are, whatever you think of them, doing exactly what you're talking about. That is a very good example of people who want discipline, who want codes. There are many, many of these groups. The other two great awakenings both came after periods of prosperity. One was right before the American Revolution, and the second one was from about 1825 to the onset of the Civil War, following economic booms. The current religious surge, starting in 1968, starts at just about the moment that American gross national product reached $1 trillion.
But do you also see in it a tacit capacity to sacrifice?
I think people love to have some kind of code. I think there's something in everyone that wants a charismatic belief, a belief that requires no logic. And religion will provide that. People love to have something that they can believe in blindly. It's very important.
And they don't believe in their communities so much anymore, do they? Except here and there in America, we have a highly mobile population, 20% change their address every year. But they do believe, don't they, still in America, as witness the utter spontaneity, acclamation of the celebration of our 200th anniversary?
I was so surprised. I was braced for the whole intellectual community to
disavow
and to turn this into something quite ugly. But instead, you're quite right. Part of it, though, was that an event had occurred whose importance will be more and more obvious as years go by. 3 years before the bicentennial, first volume of the Gulag Archipelago was published. And that was the beginning of the impossibility of any longer believing in Marxism as a spiritual force. The intellectual opposition to the United States has existed in a Marxist mist. There are not many people who can get a half Nelson on the dialectic. Well, there was always a Marxist mist. There was a paradise over the next hill where socialism would show the way. The Gulag Archipelago was an announcement to the world in unmistakable terms that socialism leads only to the concentration camp. And that, at least, was an element in the diffusing of what might have been an ugly bicentennial in 1976.
Right, and the great American intuition is that there's a difference between the kind of life we lead and the kind of life they lead, and they are impatient of any of those old bards who talked about how beautiful and utopian was life under communism. That is correct, isn't it?
That is beginning to happen for the first time since the Second World War.
That concludes the third side of our program. In the last half hour, we'll hear two different perspectives on the 1984 elections. So stay with us here as Hedrick Smith of the New York Times poses some ticklish political questions.